supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. What makes one person more curious than the other? And what impact does this phenomenon of curiosity have on one's life? Well, it turns out that curiosity is vital to our success in life and our cognitive abilities. Curiosity really is the soul of creativity. Not only that, it can be dangerous to avoid curiosity, such as when we avoid learning about some of the difficult topics affecting our planet today, such as genocides in different countries and global warming. Our guest today is Ian Leslie. He's author of the new book, Curious, The Desire to Know and Why Your Future Depends on It. Ian's based in London and writes for a variety of publications on topics of culture, politics, and ideas. His book, Born Liars, was also highly acclaimed. Ian Leslie, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
A little later in the show, actually, in just a couple of minutes, we're going to hear from Dr. Paul Harris. He's one of the researchers that Ian referred to in his book. If you are curious at all about what the show's going to be about or curious about curiosity, give us a call, 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. There's a whole lot of manifestations of curiosity, but we know one of them is asking questions. So feel free to give us a call. Ian, let's start by just getting a lay of the land with this business of curiosity. I'm assuming that all of the knowledge we've acquired as individuals and as a species was born of curiosity. Fair assumption?
Yes, I think that is a fair assumption. We are, as a species, we have evolved to seek out information, and particularly to seek out new information. And you know, as a species, again, we are. What makes us distinct is that we are very, very good at acquiring knowledge and passing it on and sharing it. So that over generations, we have built up this sort of massive collective species-wide database of knowledge. Like, you know, a wheel is a pretty good thing if you want to move a large structure around. And there are certain berries in the forest not to eat that we can then that we pass on and share. And the more each of us learns this sort of from this collective well of knowledge, the better.
Certainly, all toddlers and infants have curiosity. It's interesting. Many just assume that curiosity stayed with us from birth to death. Not so, huh?
No, I mean, we come into this world early, prematurely, you might say, compared to other mammals. It takes us a long time to literally to stand on our own 2 feet to feed ourselves and so on. But what we do is we spend that time, whilst we're dependent on adults, we spend it learning and picking up things from the world around us that are going to help us survive in later life. And that's really the kind of the biological basis for that habit that young children have of asking why. It's also the you know, why babies, even, you know, before they can talk, they are opening cupboards and running out of doors and putting dirt in their mouths, you know. So we're born with this sort of intense drive to acquire as much information, knowledge about the world as we can, both from our own experience, but also by asking adults. But then as we get older, we ask fewer questions. We actually start asking fewer questions when we get to school. It's an incredibly complex question as to why that is. Part of the reason, however, that we're starting to make connections between what we already know. We're starting to listen more. And we're also starting to realize that learning beyond a certain level gets really hard, because it requires thinking power, requires concentration and attention and focus.
Well, and
that's when motivation comes into play.
And what we're learning in today's culture is that is less available. Motivation, thinking power, so on and so forth. It's easier to be uncurious. But we're talking about children. I was surprised in your book because, I hadn't thought about the phenomenon of curiosity much, and I just assumed all infants and toddlers had it, period. It was just there. But I want to bring in Dr. Paul Harris, because you mentioned him in your book. Paul Harris is a researcher and in child cognitive and educational development at Harvard Graduate School of Education. He researched why and how children ask questions. Paul Harris, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
And thanks for taking the time to join us. So my assumption was that it was just there for infants and toddlers, but apparently it's there more or less with infants and toddlers. Some have more than others.
Well, in broad strokes, I would think you're right that every infant, every typically developing infant at least, is curious. We can tell that because if we show them something repeatedly, their attention declines, but as soon as we show them something that's a little bit different, their attention perks up again, and psychologists use this to study the kinds of differences that babies can spot. But it's true that by the time we are looking at toddlers and preschoolers, there are some differences in, for example, the number of questions that children ask and the proportion of questions that are trying to get at an explanation.
Paul, I'm curious about your work. When you studied, you and your research assistant, I think, a graduate student, I don't recall, studied when and how kids ask questions between the ages of 3 and 5. And boy, you got a lot of data there, huh?
Well, to explain a little bit, the person who really did some very pioneering work in this area was a researcher called Michelle Chouinard, and what she did was to make use of a database that psychologists have built over the years. The database was mostly directed at looking at children's, or initially directed at looking at children's acquisition of language, and especially of their acquisition of grammar. But as the years have gone on, we've realized that we can put this database to all sorts of uses. So the database consists really of a lot of computerized transcriptions of spontaneous remarks that children made, actually not just 3-year-olds, but even 2-year-olds. And so a small number of children, an increasing number of children over the years, but a small number initially, were studied in their home,
chatting
to their caregiver. What
did we find out about who was more curious, who was less, and why?
Well, broadly speaking, children vary, of course, in the speed with which they acquire language.
Sure.
So within that context, we would expect some children to ask more questions than others. But beyond that, the data suggests that children from well-educated or privileged homes are likely to ask more questions than children from less privileged homes.
Do we know?
As Ian was mentioning a moment ago, we see a big difference when children move to school. The same child asks fewer questions at school than they do at home.
Do we know why? And I'll direct this to either you, Paul, or you, Ian. Do we know why children of more privilege seem to be more curious?
We can speculate. Go ahead, Ian.
Ian?
Well, I will speculate because I'm not a scientist. I think that the main reason is that children who grew up in privileged or, you know, broadly speaking, middle class households have parents who have, a couple of things. Number one, they're just more time in order that they can interact and engage their children. Curiosity is something that you can engage and take part in once you've got the stuff of survival out of the way. If you are focused on just getting through the week and, you know, getting your household through the week to the next meal and to the end of the week, then you really just don't have time to sit around conversing with your kids, asking them questions, answering their questions, you know, suggesting books to read. And so it's a lot harder.
That makes sense. Paul, do you want to weigh in on that also?
I think that's broadly true. It's also the case that even when we look within a particular group of families, let's say middle-class families, we do find some variation. So I don't think the explanation lies entirely in, you know, lack of stress or socioeconomic consideration. So that may be part of the explanation, but beyond that, you know, parents have different stances toward their children and different attitudes towards talking. So some parents themselves ask a lot of questions, and it turns out that children who ask a lot of questions have parents who ask a lot of questions.
I think that's a really interesting distinction, because you would tend to assume that it was the parents who were answering more of their kids' questions who raised curious kids. You might sort of assume it and leave it there if you like, but actually, yeah, as Paul says, that it wasn't about answering, it was about asking questions.
Well, I mean,
when parents who say, you know, what do you think? I don't know. Have you thought about this? Are the parents who are raising curious kids?
One of the things I'm learning, I believe, and I'll ask the two of you, is that the answers are almost secondary to the process. That once you get an answer, then you're not curious anymore.
Well, I wouldn't go that far.
Okay.
First of all,
rein me in here.
Yes. So when children get an answer, it's likely that they may ask a further question building on what they've just learned. So there were a couple of British investigators who's describe among four-year-olds some striking examples of this, what they call passages of intellectual search. So the child might be puzzled as to why you pay money under certain circumstances, and the child would ask a fairly tenacious series of questions trying to get clear on what, after all, is a complicated business. Since you know, you don't pay everybody, and sometimes you give them some money, and then they give you some money back in the form of change. So from the, you know, the bird's eye view of a four-year-old, this is a puzzling situation.
Our own Terry Gross here at WHYY, who hosts Fresh Air, and you know, she's won many, many awards based on her curiosity. I mean, the title of her book was All I Did Was Ask. And she talks about her childhood where she would ask, and in hindsight, she thought these ridiculous questions. But, you know, her parents respected it, and they helped her find answers, and they nurtured it and asked if there was any more questions she had about that. And, you know, they just helped her learn. So, you know, it's how we react to their curiosity. And you know, look, we're humans. You know, Ian, I heard the tone in your voice when you said, when they ask why all the time. You know, damn, it's annoying sometimes, you know?
And parents, you know, it's easy to hand them an iPad and just say, you know, go and look it up. I totally understand that, particularly when you're busy or harassed and so on, but it comes with a cost.
That's right. That's right. When my kids were growing up, we didn't have iPads, but we did have Mr. Rogers. So I don't know who wins. Paula, I know you have to go, and I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us, and the research is really, really fascinating.
You're welcome.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye now.
That was Dr. Paul Harris. He's a researcher in the cognitive and emotional development. He's with the Harvard Graduate School of Education. You can read more about his work and Ian Leslie's book. If you're just joining us, we're talking about curiosity. We're going to get to the phones in a minute, actually just after this next break. Our number is 888-477-9499. What's your experience with your own curiosity? What has nurtured it over the course of your life? What has inhibited it? Really curious to know about you and your experience with curiosity. 888-477-9499. We're talking with Ian Leslie today. He's a London-based author of the new book, Curious, The Desire to Know Why, to Know, and Why Your Future Depends on It. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
The College of Nursing at Villanova University offers a Doctor of Nursing Practice program designed for advanced practice nurses and nurse administrators. With full or part-time options and rolling admission, Villanova's online DNP includes on-campus seminars and interdisciplinary faculty who support you in translating nursing science to improve healthcare outcomes. Cohorts start each June. Villanova's Doctor of Nursing Practice program supports WHYY. Villanova.edu/nursing/DNP.
Hi, I'm filmmaker Ken Burns. You choose WHYY because you appreciate the shows it delivers every day, because it offers something different. WHYY provides trustworthy news coverage, offers a gateway to the arts, and educates viewers and listeners of all ages with support from individuals like you. Visit WHYY.org or call 888-345-9499. And as always, thank you.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Hey, I'm curious about something. I'm curious about what curiosity is, and I'm curious about you, our listeners. I'm curious about your experience with curiosity. So for the latter question, you can call us at 888-477-9499. For the former question, we're going to be talking with Ian Leslie, who's written the book Curious, The Desire to Know and Why Your Future Depends on It. But let me ask you about that subtitle for a minute, Ian. Why does our future depend on it?
Well, I mean, it's always been good to be a curious person in lots of different ways. But in the book, I argue that it's more important than ever to your future that you are curious or that you raise curious children. That's for a couple of reasons. One is that people who are curious, genuinely curious, tend to do better in education. And the people who spend longer in education, who spend 4 years plus in higher education, are the people to whom a greater and greater share of our country's resources are going. So if you're a curious person, you're more likely to do that, to spend more time in education, and then therefore you're more likely to have a better and higher paid career at the end of it. And the second reason is that industries across the board are becoming more cognitively demanding, more complex, and more collaborative. also. And both those things require curiosity, right? So if you're a curious person, you're going to be better at getting into the complexities of your subject, whether it's software engineering or finance or law or whatever it is. But you'll also be better at collaborating with individuals and teams from other disciplines, because you'll be, you know, interested in what they have to say, and you'll pick it up much more quickly because you're already a kind of widely read person with a broad background of knowledge. So just from a kind of point of view, is your future success, it's incredibly important that you are and you remain and you work at being a curious person.
Well, that makes all the sense in the world. Let's go to the phones. We've got Greg on the line. Hey, Greg.
Hey, good morning.
Good afternoon. Yes, afternoon here. What can we do for you?
I'd done a piece on curiosity for Forbes magazine and had spoken on the importance of hiring employees with curiosity.
I just read that article, actually. It was in February.
Right. So I liked what your previous guest was just saying about the sort of the practical aspects of curiosity. When I view curiosity, it's more on a personal basis. So instead of being someone who is victimized or someone who is judgmental, you can be someone with curiosity. So anytime someone sacrifices curiosity, they tend to substitute defensive behaviors. Hmm. And therefore, when we're hiring people for curiosity, we're really focused on asking them questions to see, is their response sort of victim thinking? Is their response judgmental and blaming? Or is it more of, I wonder why that person behaves the way that they do, or I wonder what the solution is to this particular problem? So I would think that if we could hire people who were less defensive and more curious, we would probably be able to make a significant impact on the health of our organization and its culture.
You know, my research, don't go anywhere, Greg, because I want to bring this up with both you and Ian. You know, as I'm culling over whatever I can about curiosity, and especially Ian's book, there's this thread that comes through this almost parallel to Buddhism. It's like you greet an experience as an experience, you observe it with curiosity, with almost dispassion, like, oh, this is what's happening now. What can I learn about it? What do I know about it? And what they encourage you to do is have a beginner's mind. And Ian, you alluded to that in your book. You know, it's like having a child's mind of curiosity.
It is, but it should be. It's not quite having a child's mind, because you also want to acquire as much knowledge as you can, and yet have a bit of the child's impulse there at the same time. If you see what I mean? But, children really don't know very much, right? And we wouldn't ask them to run large organisations and so on for a reason. But what they do have is, as you're alluding to, is that kind of impulse to ask why, and we shouldn't lose that. I mean, my sort of version of this, and again, this is somebody who was influenced by Eastern philosophy, was Steve Jobs' sort of the way when he talked to he gave a commencement address at Stanford, and he finished it with the words of a mentor of his called Stuart Brand. He said, "Stay hungry, stay foolish." And that for me is, you know, kind of a great pithy summary of what you're talking about. Stay hungry, stay foolish. Continue to be aware of what you don't know, and be excited by that.
Hmm. George Lowenstein said that curiosity, the curiosity and the drive for it, is influenced by what he called the information gap. Greg, you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I was just thinking in terms of innovation. Often, the enemy of innovation is in-depth expertise, and I think the reason for that is the more that you think you know about something, probably the less curious you may be about it. And it takes a special mindset to remain open to being curious after you have a high amount of knowledge, because I think it's certainly quite possible to shut down conversation or creativity because you lose your edge of curiosity because of your knowledge. So when you talk about the mind of a child, I think it's, you know, there are people who have extreme amounts of knowledge, and yet their curiosity makes them very approachable by others, because despite their expertise, they're still open to learning the next new thing, or they're just interested in what other people think about that.
Yeah, Pablo Picasso would agree. Pablo Picasso said this of computers. He said, "What good are computers? All they do is give you answers."
Yeah, I mean, and they are terrific. You know, computers are amazing sources of answers and amazing tools for us to explore our curiosity, but only if we ask them good questions. You know, and good questions come from knowing a lot, but also always being aware that there's a lot you don't know. And so I think Greg's absolutely right that expertise can get in the way of, I mean, it shouldn't, but it can get in the way of curiosity.
Well,
unless you adopt this curious mindset where the more you know, the more you want to know.
My concern in this culture is that ignorance or not knowing is become a source of shame, that it's embarrassing not to know in this culture. That's the message that And this starts as early as elementary school, that you simply must know. So, you know, we hide from what we don't know.
I think it's a real problem. I mean, unconscious ignorance is the worst thing in the world, right? So being ignorant of stuff and not really knowing that you're ignorant and not caring that you might be ignorant is you know, kind of the opposite of curiosity. Conscious ignorance, where you are aware of the stuff you don't know and you want to fill that gap, is basically what George Lohenstein is talking about, is what curiosity is for. And you're right, if there is a sort of a cultural imperative to always be in command of knowledge and knowing stuff, then it means we fail to explore that ignorance because we feel embarrassed. It starts at school. I mean, there's a teaching expert called Doug Lemov who says the best thing a teacher can do for a child is to create a culture of error, you know, and which is a funny thing for a teaching expert to say, but he's saying, you know, I want kids to know it's okay not to know, it's okay to make mistakes. Otherwise, you're right, they're retreating to their shell.
Not only that, but it's important. I want to move on to what nurtures this phenomenon called curiosity and what inhibits it. We've got a caller that's addressing just that point. Let's go to the phones. We've got Bobby on the line. Hi, Bobby.
Hey, good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. This topic interests me because the life that I live right now as a reporter is just as a result of the curiosity that was stoked in me when I was a child. My father, who was a single parent, raised me in an era when children were to be seen, not heard. And it was not, within our culture, it was not acceptable to treat a child as an adult or speak to a child as an adult. And he always spoke with me about world affairs, asked me how I felt about things, and encouraged my dialogue and encouraged my sense of exploration. And even today, you know, as a result of that, I consider myself a curiosity reporter or curiosity correspondent of sorts, one that's just following, you know, her nose and a forever student.
Well, that is the nature of curiosity. And I don't, aren't all reporters curious? Aren't all interviewers curious, radio hosts?
They ought to be.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, they're not always, and that applies to any job. I mean, I think it's wonderful to hear what Bobby was saying there about her dad and how he raised her, and I just think that's one of the, you know, after love, perhaps that's the greatest gift you can give a child, you know, to make them interested in the world and to get them used to asking questions and exploring topics and building a knowledge. You know, I got that from my parents. I feel very lucky. And I just think it's a wonderful gift to pass on.
You know, I didn't get that, my curiosity, from my parents. I got my curiosity from feeling different from everyone else. So I wanted to know what it was like inside of everyone else. So that's the beginning of my psychology career. You know, like, what's it like to be you? How does your mind work? What do you think about? You know, so my curiosity was born, I guess, from feeling different or loneliness. So it can come from anywhere, I assume.
Yeah, in the book, I talk about empathic curiosity. It was one of the forms of curiosity I discuss, which is exactly what you say. It's curiosity about the minds of others and what it would be like, you know, what's it like to think like this person. And, yeah, a good interviewer or a good therapist, you know, or a doctor of any kind, they have this amazing empathic curiosity. They genuinely want to know what this person is thinking and feeling. And again, I think it's connected to the other type of curiosity, knowledge, epistemic curiosity, I call it. You know, because the more people that you're interested in, probably the more you're going to learn from them. So the two things intersect.
Mm. Bobby, thanks so much for your call you know, shedding this light. I'm still curious about you and your background, but we'll deal with that later. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Jerry on the line. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How about you?
I'm good. You know, in my 30s, I had a very good job and I had some time on my hands, so I went to take a graduate course. And the counselor said to me, well, what do you want to do with this information? What kind of job do you want to get? And I go, I already have a job. I just want to know. And she could not comprehend it. I got up to leave. Another person sat down and she said, well, I hope you have more goals than that last guy because he had no clue. And I'm wondering how often curiosity doesn't have to be goal-driven. Sometimes it's just a yearning to know or to understand. And I wonder how many people that counselor's curiosity she destroyed.
Well, I'm guessing that she didn't destroy your curiosity, but
not mine. No.
But I, you know, you do make an important point, and I want to turn to you, Ian. I mean, you've really culled the research here, and what does destroy curiosity? And you know, a lot of people point fingers at schools, not just specifically Jerry's situation, but, you know, teachers who discourage questions or worse, you know, embarrass students for asking stupid questions.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest killer of curiosity is fear and insecurity. And when people are made to feel, you know, intimidated or for being curious or if they're told, you know, you don't need to know anything except what we're going to tell you you need to know. Or if they're told, you know, you just need to learn what you need in order to get ahead, as our caller was told, then that's what kills curiosity, unless it's very resilient. And that's what we've got to avoid. But, you know, both at home and in our schools and in society generally, we've got to make people feel confident in the kind of free play of a curiosity that isn't directed at particular goals. I mean, I talk in the book, you know, I say why your future depends on it, and I say it's very important to your future, more important than ever, that you are curious. But I also say, you know, but beyond that, it's just great to be a curious person. It's the most kind of fulfilling way to live your life.
Well, it's more than just great. Tell us about the brain science and dopamine and curiosity. That was some fascinating stuff you wrote about.
Yeah, I mean, the neuroscientists neuroscientist called Colin Cameron did some very interesting research where he put participants in a brain scanner and then basically measured the point at which he asked them a series of questions while they were in a scanner, and then detected what was happening in their brains when they were searching for an answer to a question that they'd been posed, or when they were interested in an answer. And he found that when they got the answer, they got a little burst of dopamine. Dopamine is a neurotransmitter that's associated with rewards, the kind of reward that you get, the rush of good feeling or pleasure that you get when you eat good food or when you kiss someone you love. And, you know, it was just really fascinating to hear that, because it's like our desire for knowledge seems to have evolved on the back of our most primal desires, you know, for food and sex. And that over time, evolution has kind of built this, desire for new information on top of that kind of most basic part of the brain. So now we get this dopamine rush, this feeling of pleasure when we find out the answer to a question that we were curious about.
That's great. That's just great. And so that if I'm struggling and I can't get the answer to a question, I'll be just as happy if I kiss someone I love?
Maybe you can kiss someone after they've told you the answer.
Well done. Well done. Let's take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk about what really does nurture curiosity over the lifespan, because people do seem on the surface to become less curious as they age. We're talking about curiosity with Ian Leslie, a London-based author, and he's written, his new book is called Curious, The Desire to Know to know and why your future depends on it. We'd love to hear from you also. Our number is 888-477-9499. How did your family of origin deal with curiosity, and how did you deal with it in your children? I'd also like to know your experience with curiosity. Do you feel you are curious? Would you like to be more curious? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY FM.
Does your son or daughter come home drunk or high? Would you like to learn new ways of dealing with their drug or alcohol use? The Family Training Program works with parents of children aged 12 to 25 to help them maintain control of their child's drug or alcohol problem. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More on the Family Training Program at 877-I-WORRY-2. That's 877-I-WORRY and the number 2. Or online at iamconcerned.org.
I'm Robin Young. Methodist pastor Frank Schaefer says he wasn't trying to create a controversy when he officiated his son's gay wedding, but his act divided the church he loves. Pastor Frank is out with a new book that tells his story from post-war Germany to discovering he had 3 gay children. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We're back on Voices in the Family. We're talking about curiosity today, which is really an interesting phenomenon to talk about. We're doing it with Ian Leslie, who's written Curious, The Desire to Know and Why Your Life Depends on It. Our number is 888-477-9499. And Adam, let's go right to the phones. We've got William from Collingdale on the line. Hi, William.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Thanks for allowing my question. I'm a parent of an eighth grader, rather strong performer in school, interested in sciences and does well in math and in art. And she's always asking questions that I think that she could very easily answer herself. And I tell her at times that I'd really like her to be not a lazy thinker. And I don't want to, you know, squash your curiosity. What type of some boundaries, some borders, you know, that I could say, I want to encourage her, you know, to be able to be a strong thinker. I want her to be curious, and I want her to feel like she can come and ask questions. But, you know, some of the questions really are, I think, you know, kindergarten questions.
So, William, did you call us today because you were curious about what to do?
Oh, indeed. Okay. I mean, I'm curious, so I listen to your show.
Well, thank you.
I feel like as a parent, there's lots that I can always learn.
All right.
So I'm a researcher.
All right. So let's let Ian Leslie weigh in on this, and then I've got some thoughts.
Well, I wouldn't presume to give parenting advice, but I would say that you're right. You know, I love the principle that you're trying to inculcate in your daughter, which is don't be a lazy thinker. And that means, you know, I think it means one of the things it means is don't always accept the first answer that you get. You know, so don't always accept the answer that comes at the top of the Google search. That's a kind of shortcut to knowledge, and it can be a good starting point, but it's not the end of your inquiry. But it also means acquiring knowledge, you know, and working hard at learning stuff. You know, epistemic curiosity, which is the kind of curiosity where you're gaining knowledge, is hard work. It requires, you know, attention and focus and concentration. Sometimes it can be frustrating when you don't, you know, you thought you learned something but you didn't, and you have to go back to it. But it pays off. You know, man, does it pay off. And here's the great thing about it. The more you learn, the easier it is to learn. Mm-hmm. The more knowledge you have in your brain, then the easier it is for new knowledge to find purchase in the existing networks of knowledge in your brain. So well, there's a kind of get richer effect when it comes to learning.
William, let me comment also as from the perspective of parenting. She is, did you say 13 years old?
That is correct.
Okay. So she comes to you with a question, and that question is born of curiosity. So that's a good thing. You tell her to go research it herself because you're being a good parent and you respect her research abilities. But I wouldn't stop it there. See, don't just say we're done with that part now and let's move on to the next. I'd like to see you nurture it. Go back to her. What did you find out? Ask her more questions. What can we learn about that? Well, I wonder if that answers that question, that raises some other questions in my mind. What about your mind? And continue to nurture this phenomenon, this budding phenomenon of curiosity at this level. So you're doing great, and you know you want to make yourself curious about what she's curious about, and curiosity.
Yeah, I was going to say that sounds really important. You know, exactly as you say, getting curious about it yourself. You know, whatever she's interested in is really going to be the key to this, because suddenly it becomes a joint project, and curiosity is really, you know, works best, you know, when it works as a collaboration, particularly within the family.
Hmm. So I hope that was helpful for you, William. Take care.
Thank you for such great insight.
Yeah, enjoy what sounds like a wonderful 13-year-old daughter.
Sure.
Absolutely.
Enjoy. So, Ian, let's go back to the phones. We got a lot of people who want to join the conversation. Let's go to Jack. Hi, Jack.
Oh, hi. Can you hear me?
Can hear you well, thank you.
Oh, great. I was always the one in my classes that would have five questions, and somehow, in most of the class, no one else asked questions, and somehow the teachers would always kind of bully me to shut up so they could get through their talk, and I have a 2-year-old son, and he seems to be just as curious as me, and I want to protect him so that he can stand up for himself and say, well, we're paying you, teacher, and we want you to answer our questions. What do I do?
Well, if your two-year-old son were to stand up in kindergarten and make that statement to his teacher, you would find yourself in a psychologist's office pronto. So, and you know, I would be saying, thank God it wasn't me. So I don't know about this business of protecting. It's, you know, protecting, you know, one thing I learned from Ian today, that protecting someone is fear-based. And fear inhibits curiosity. Yet, Ian, what are your thoughts?
I think that's absolutely right. And obviously, you know, it really comes down to the teachers. And the best thing you can do in this regard is just try to ensure that, you know, that your teachers are doing a good job, because they're not doing a good job if they're shutting down a kid's curiosity. You know, they're only doing a good job if they're feeding it. And that means, it means teaching them stuff. It means giving them the information and the knowledge they need and the skills they need. But it also means inculcating that spirit of inquiry. And that, you know, really it should be the ultimate goal of all teaching. So, you know, unless they're doing that, they're just not doing a good job, and you should tell them.
Boy.
So instead of protecting the child, you should really encourage the teacher. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly, well put. Yeah.
And encourage the child also. Nurture their curiosity. Let's, Ian, there's a lot of people with a lot of important questions about curiosity, so we're just going to stick with the phones for now. Let's go to John. Hi, John.
Hello, how you doing?
Good. How about you?
Yeah, I'm calling. I'm a physician, so calling noted your curiosity in the workplace, and I think the medical field has become one of the largest workplaces in the United States, and we're all trained clinically from an empathic and knowledge curiosity basis, and it seems that medicine at now, we've sort of been channeled, but in our clinical side, as you may note, our curiosity is still strong and enhanced, but when the structure of what we're doing and everything we do, we turn our curiosity there, it is being stifled and sometimes rejected. And essentially, we're becoming where we should be curious in one section and definitely not be curious in the other structural section of what's happening in medicine.
So what do you do? Don't talk about we. Let's talk about John for the moment. What do you do to nurture your curiosity?
My standpoint, I go stronger into the clinical, and from my wife's advice, I turn outside medicine for curiosity outside the medical field.
So you're able to maintain your curiosity in a field where it feels less and less welcome.
Yeah, so I stick to the clinical side where, you know, if you're not curious clinically, I don't think you survive.
Yeah, you're a bad doctor.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
But if you look to how you're functioning and how your whole world is functioning and processes, if your curiosity is not actually preferred.
Well, you know, John, I appreciate the call, and that sets up a question I wanted to ask Ian, and I will right now. And you know, John's predicament there reminds me of the question that I wanted to ask you about the big picture. You know, the big picture. Ask the big why. Tell us about that. You said in order to stay curious, we have to ask the big why.
Yeah, I mean, there's a tendency to substitute, increasingly there's a tendency to substitute large amounts of data and information for inquiry. So, you know, we talk about one of the new phenomena of the digital age is big data. You know, we have massive processing capacity and massive amounts of data on everything and everyone. And some have proposed that, you know, all we need to do is study what happens. Now, we don't have to look at the underlying causes or motivations. We don't have to ask why anymore. And, you know, I think this is crazy. And again, I come back to the thing I was talking about computers earlier. Computers are great for answers, but They only work really well when you ask them the right question. And the right questions always cluster around those why and how questions. So we've got to cultivate that.
I do that as a clinician. And, you know, I ask many of my patients why, the big picture of why. Why do you work as hard as you do? Why do you push your children? And really, underneath all your formulaic answers that you have, why do you? And what is your life about? And what do you want it to be about? I think it's so important to ask the big questions. And when they begin not to have answers for me, you can see curiosity just get sparked inside.
I agree. And it's so important, but it's so easy to get by without doing it, you know, in many cases.
Oh, yeah.
You can just go through the same routines. And I think that's true in your life, but also, you know, in business and in work. You see so many businesses who were successful for a long time go into decline and then go bust because they were basically going through the same routines. They knew how to make money, and so they just structured themselves around doing the same thing over and over again. And nobody at the top was asking the big why. You know, nobody's saying, well, hang on a minute. Why are we still in this business? Why don't we go move into this business? Why do we have this product? Why? And people like Steve Jobs were tremendously good at saying, why are we doing this? Why are we making this computer? Why are we making this laptop? Why don't we do this instead? And unless you have somebody at board level asking those big questions,
well,
then you can just sort of slowly think.
And on an individual level, we can ask them of ourselves. Ian Leslie, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a fascinating show and a fascinating book you've put together.
Thank you very much. Really enjoyed it. Thank you for having me.
Me too. Next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to be talking about the disconnect in the medical community between our mental and physical health and how we could bridge that gap. Well, to download our podcast, go to whyy.org/voices. We are on Twitter. It's at Voices in the Fam. And you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Hear about my upcoming lectures. The engineer for today's show has been Adam Staniszewski. Lindsay Carfagno is our intern par excellence. Elizabeth Perez-Luner is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Gita Simons produces this show. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.